succession number 29703, reel 1.
There aren't too many of you this time, but we appreciate those that came, and we want to welcome you on behalf of the 8th Air Force Memorial Museum Foundation, the sponsor of these symposium. And today we have a panel beginning with the escape and evasion and following with a prisoner of war. And Roger Freeman is to be our moderator. I think you all know Roger. If you don't, you haven't read much about the 8th Air Force, because he's our expert and our historian, and we're really pleased to have him. And I'll turn the program over to Roger Freeman.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Can you hear me? Yes, you can. Welcome. Today, we are going to deal with two subjects, but they both concern what happened to the guys that didn't come back. That is, the guys that lived from those aircraft that were missing in action. We have two sessions. The first deals with escape and evasion, the second with POWs. And we'll start with escape and evasion. It is said that of those airmen who reached the ground safely, uninjured, you stood a 10-to-1 chance in favor of being helped out of the occupied countries that you've come down in to fight again. And it is estimated that some 5,000 people, Allied servicemen, were helped out of occupied Europe by various brave helpers. And of those, about 2,500 to 3,000 were American servicemen. But there was a grim part to all this, because it is also estimated that for every person, every Allied airman helped out, there was one brave helper executed by the Germans. However, enough from me. Let me introduce the guests, and we have some very well-known and very brave people sitting at this table. But I'm going to start by introducing Ralph Patton on my left. He is the sole ex-evader, ex-airman on the panel. He, one day, in fact, January the 5th, 1944, didn't come back from a raid on Bordeaux. He was flying with the 94th Bomb Group. He landed in France, but was helped out and was back in England some weeks later. And I'm going to call on Ralph to introduce the other members of the panel. Ralph, incidentally, is the president of the Escape and Evasion Society over here in the States. And for many, many years, he has been actively concerned with contact with those courageous people in occupied Europe who did so much all those years ago. Ralph.
Thank you, Roger. I'd like to start off so that everyone clearly understands my purpose in being here. I'm not here to recite my tale of derring do during the war. I'm here to introduce and to try to convey to you people some of the heroic actions of the people on the panel. I was one of the fortunate ones that came out, and I'd like for you to know some of the people that were responsible for that. When the idea of the panel came up, I requested permission to introduce these wonderful people. And I hope you'll bear with me as I go through just a little bit of what they mean to me. I don't intend at this time to go into detail as to their exploits. Perhaps some of those will come out during the course of the conversations up here. I'd like to start on my left with Leslie Atkinson. Leslie is here today representing the French Underground. We have other members of the French Underground in the audience. And I would like to mention to you that during the course of this session, you will probably hear some conversations up front. We have some very dear friends in the audience who do not speak English, and we hope that some of their neighbors will translate a little bit for them, and I hope that you will not find that a distraction. Leslie Atkinson's father was English, and his father died when Leslie was young, and Leslie lived in France all of his life. When the war came, he was at that age that most of us were, and we got caught up in the war. As part of his activities, he sheltered American airmen in his home. He then went out and lived in the Maquis, worked with the resistance people, and acted to some extent as an interpreter for the American forces as they came into France. Leslie retired as of September the 30th. He was a chief of services for one of the largest plants in Paris, and we're just so pleased to have Leslie, who is the official representative of the Air Force's Escape and Evasion Society in France. So when we go to France, we know we have a friend there, and we've brought that friend over here to have an opportunity to talk with you, and it is my pleasure to introduce to you Leslie Atkinson. On my immediate left is Captain Harrison of British Military Intelligence Service, alias Leon, alias this, alias that, Andre. His wife knew him as Andre. He didn't even know, she doesn't know him by more than six names. But in any event, Lucien was a sergeant major in the Fusiliers Mont Royal, from Montreal. And he was part of that intrepid group that invaded the continent at Dieppe and ran into a disaster area. They were cut off. He was part of the rear guard, was captured, escaped from a train on its way to prison camp, made his way to the south of France, and escaped by way of the Pas-d'Oliry line on the ship Tirana. Yes, he came. He'll tell you about it. But in any event, his stories are legends. There are books about him. After he got back to England, then, he went back into France, and into France to organize Réseau Shelburne. And as the organizer and the chief of Réseau Shelburne, they never lost a package, which we were packages, or sack of potatoes, or whatever code name they wanted to use. But Réseau Shelburne never lost a package. It is indeed a very distinct privilege for us to have with us the chief of Réseau Shelburne, plus as many other activities, which I hope he'll tell you about, my good friend Lucien Dumais. On Roger's right, we have Anne Brusselmans, formerly of Belgium, currently living in Montreal. And when we extended an invitation for her to come, it was in her usual pleasant voice, "Oh, by a yes, I would be most happy to come." And so here she is. But in any event, during the war, Anne was the business manager for Baroness Tankard. And during our trip to France in Holland, Belgium, and France in 1969, she arranged with the Baroness to have a fantastic reception for us at the castle or the chateau or what it might be called. But in any event, during the war, Anne, her mother was English, and therefore she spoke almost fluent English, and she did a lot of interrogating and a questioning of the airmen. And I think it's one time or another, perhaps my numbers are off by 10 or so, but I think approximately 90 airmen came by her desk or her interrogation or her sheltering. This is a fantastic example of the courage of women in World War II, and I think we're very, very fortunate to have a woman of the resistance of the caliber of Anne Brusselmans on this panel. Anne, thank you very much for coming with us. And on the far right, we have Gus Oderkirchen. And Gus is the representative of the Dutch resistance organizations. He is a member of the board of directors of the Escape, and they work in close liaison with the Allied Air Crew Helpers, which is an organization that has been most kind to AFEES and I'm sure our Canadian counterpart, the Royal Canadian Air Force Escaping Evasion Society. And I would like to acknowledge, while I may, I see at least two members of the RCAFES here. Is Pierre and Monique are here. We have three representatives from our counterpart in Canada who have, for the past 20 years been most kind to me, and the liaison with the American AFES and the RAFES has just been outstanding. And I'd like to acknowledge the presence of these three couples from Toronto and two from Montreal, Ross and Peggy Williams, Pierre and Monique Boucher, and Jack and Marge Gonlight. Would you stand up? Just is that the three of you? The reason I interrupted my glowing tribute to Anne to do that is Jack was in Belgium, and Jack Gonlock was part of the group that went back in 1969. Well, all three of them were. And so we affected just a fantastic relationship with Anne Brusselmans at that time, because most of us were not in her care during the war. I believe there is one airman here today who was in her care, and I hope that he'll identify himself at some point in time. Welcome, Anne. She says she has three here. You know, I really got all... Now we'll go back to the real party that we've started. Is there another one here? Would that help with my hand? Thank you. Gus, we're now going to introduce Gus. Honest to God, we are. Gus is representative of the two organizations in Holland, and during the war, he was down in the province of Limburg, which is a little lip that goes down between Belgium and Germany, and it is Holland down in there, and he was at Roermond down at that point. And as in that area, he was responsible for getting the guys that were able to get out of POW camps in Germany and get across that little neck of Holland and get them into Belgium. And they would take them to the Dilsen windmill in Belgium, and then Gus would turn around and go back into Limburg and wait for some other one. Occasionally, he would go all the way to Liège. He took, they would go, he had a steam-driven streetcar where they would go from the windmill over to Tongeren, and then from Tongeren, they'd go to Liège by electric streetcar. And I think that Gus has a lot of stories that he could tell about the techniques of moving under the, as the French say, the barb and beard of the German. And so, Gus has said at the time that he saw many Americans, but he didn't remember any names. And it's very difficult for him to be coming here, like maybe with Anne, it's old home week. But with Gus, it's coming to see, perhaps renew some acquaintances, hopefully, and to meet old friends in effect again. But Gus represents the Dutch resistance movement, of which I think about a third of our members started in Holland and worked their way down through. So it's a pleasure to have the representative of the Escape and the Allied Air Crew Helpers Association of Holland, Gus Oderkirchen. Rogers.
Well, thank you, Ralph.
Turn it back to him.
I knew I was going to anyhow.
Thank you, Ralph. Well, let's begin. And I think we should begin when an airman was coming down on his parachute or was escaping from his crashed aircraft. And as a passing thought, you may be interested to know that 37 years ago, at this very minute, there was one person within this room who was, in fact, doing just that, floating down on his parachute, having left his aircraft over Holland, and wondering, no doubt, to himself whether he was going into a POW camp or whether he was going to be able to evade capture. And in fact, he did evade capture. And it is Claude Murray sitting in the front row. Well, I'm sure there are many others here who evaded. So how was it done? Well, it was done, as you realize, chiefly through the goodwill of many courageous people in the occupied countries. Now, when the US AAF began operations from Europe in 1942, escape routes were already in being, that is, organized escape routes. And I expect we'd like to know how many organizations were operating in occupied countries and where they were based and to where they passed their evaders. And I think that we should put this to the former MI9 representative, Lucien Dumais.
Sir.
Can you tell us about the various organizations that existed when, in 42, the American Air Force appeared on the scene, the escape lines that were in existence then, and where they were passing the people that came into their hands?
Well, the first thing I must say is that I did not belong to the office of MI9. I was a field man. So, of course, the less I knew about the organizations, other organizations, the better for me and for others. Well, I knew, of course, Shelburne and a previous one, which was Oak Tree. And there was a Comet line. There was Pat O'Leary was a very important one. And the Dutch Orange... And Comet, well, I've just said that. And that's about all I know. There were probably others. But our business, of course, in the field was to stay away from all the other things. Mind our own business. Especially don't let anybody know about us. And don't investigate somebody else. So I'm very poor on the knowledge there. I can't say much more than that.
Ralph, can you tell us about the organizations that were in existence?
Well, I can tell you from an airman's point of view, we didn't even know such a thing existed. We found out later that this was an organized network in our case. And since the war, I found that there were a series of networks. Some operated on their own, and they had some contact with MI9. And others operated directly by MI9, with the agents being sent in by Lysander or Halifax, parachuted in. So there were all kinds, and if you read the history books, you'll see names like Oak Tree and Burgundy and Comet and Dutch Paris and O'Leary. There are literally a couple of dozen escape networks. MI9, to my knowledge, had a handle on most of them and knew they were operating. But MI9 could never really get to Comet, is my understanding. As far as the Belgians were concerned, that MI9 would try to direct them. And so that you run the gamut where Shelburne was an MI9 network. Oak Tree, I think, when it started, was an MI9 network. Comet cooperated to the best of their ability with MI9, but they preferred to, in effect, operate independently to the best extent possible. And perhaps then could shed some light on Comet.
Yes, I can. Comet was specially organized by Belgians, run by Belgians, but we did have help from England. That we certainly did, as far as money was concerned, but we received no orders from England. Not that we didn't want to, but to us, by the time that England knew what was happening, everything had changed. And if they had sent us then orders to do things that were absolutely against the situation at that time, we would never have been able to have done what we've done.
Well, thank you very much. Perhaps we should tell the good people here what MI9 was. I don't think we've explained that. Ralph, can you say exactly what MI9 was?
Well, MI9, of course, was military intelligence in Section 9. Was that branch of the English military or British military intelligence that was charged with helping airmen. And I truly regret that illness prevented Colonel Langley from being with us today, who was the direct CO of MI9 at the latter part of the war. But in any event, MI9 had some difficulty in getting the attention of the military authorities and the Air Force top brass. Fortunately, Brigadier Crockett supported them, and he was evidently powerful enough to have a go at it, as they say in England. But in any event, MI9 was only concerned with evading personnel, as I understand it, and mostly it was geared towards airmen. They did bring out, and I know Lucian can say, they brought out Czechs and Poles and other people than airmen. But that seemed to be the bulk of the traffic. Am I right in that?
Quite right. In fact, we were not allowed to take out anybody except Air Force men or Army men from the Allied services. Others, they had to have a very good reason for trying to get across to England. Because, first of all, we had other things to do. Our main target being escaping airmen. And secondly, not getting any spies into England, which was quite easy to do, of course. But they got as far as the checking point there, and they no further, because they usually were spotted up.
Well, let's look at some of these organized escape setups in occupied countries. One wonders just how big they were and what sort of people they employed. Perhaps we better ask several members of the panel that. So let's start with Gus Oudekerken. How big an organization was the one that you worked for? Were there many people, and what were their livelihoods?
There were just a few. The men or the women who took airmen to me, French prisoners who escaped, Jewish people who want to go to Switzerland, they took it to me, and another man gave me an indication where I could find them. And then I brought them through over the River Maas, what was much more dangerous, not for me, but for the men in my car. They should not talk. Nobody should know they spoke English, of course. And then I took them to Dilsen in Belgium. There was a windmill. And lady, she knows about it. And that windmill was a very easy pound, because if the wings from the windmill were in a good position, I could enter. If it was in a bad position, there was alarm.
What sort of people were engaged in this work? I mean, were they farmers, or were they drawn from all walks?
All kinds of people. To begin, in Dilsen was a castle, this noble gentleman. He was after the, in 1943, he was made prisoner and killed. There was the miller, that was a lady called Gertrude Moors. She was also arrested in 1943 and killed in Ravensbrück. Sorry? Because we had it, I don't know. I lost trace of course in 1943. And there were the, what you call a notaire, you know? And,
Were there about a dozen people then running the organization?
Oh, yes. Lots of them. But the men I delivered in Liège personally, they went to the Comet, and that's for the first time I know that I went to the Comet today. I brought them to a church, and the church I left them, and then it was the Église Saint-Denis where I left them, and then they were brought to Paris, probably first to Brussels, Paris. But I lost every trace. I didn't know any name, no religion. It was all the same. Somebody should help, and there was help, that's all.
Well, let's turn to you, Madam Brusselmans. You were in Comet, which was a fairly large organization. Can you tell us, at a guess, how many people were involved in Comet?
I think around about 1,200. But we had 226 people who died. Some were shot, and some were died in the concentration camp. But I think that it was about 1,500.
And again, these people came from all
walks of life. You had to have people helping you all the time. You needed policemen. You needed everybody who could help.
Thank you. Would anybody else like to comment, Mr. Atkinson? Have you anything to say?
Well, I think one of the airmen was shot down. His chance was to meet somebody in a field, and it could be an old man as well as a young girl, somebody good willing, and the first move was to keep him far from the German and give him help if he was wounded, and food, you see. And during the first hour, he was very hunted. After, when the time was passed, he had more chance to find safety. That is what I wanted to say.
Thank you. Well, let's go back to the airmen again. I've always wondered whether airmen were instructed on what to do to evade capture. And I think here we've got to turn to Ralph and Lucien Dumais again. Ralph, would you like to say first what you recall about that?
Well, I suppose my memory is not much better or worse than most of the airmen in the room, and we go back 35 years or so to try to remember a briefing session as to what the intelligence officer told us. My recollection is that we had usually a briefing session with an escaped airman or an evading airman. And, of course, they showed us what was in the escape kits and the maps and the photographs that we were supposed to carry, gave us instructions as to what to do when you were shot down, of course, bury your parachute and get it out of the trees and do all those good things, hide, do not try to travel too far in the first few hours, approach a house where there's only one or two people, don't go into the cities, try to approach a farm, lay low. I guess I don't really remember too much of it. You had to try to find help. I think that was the admonition. You had to have help. Very seldom that people got out on their own. Now, there are several airmen who escape without help of organizations, but I don't think they escape without help of individuals. And you differentiate an individual from an organization. You can say they were fed by people or they were directed by people. In my own individual case, we wandered around for 3 days and probably met 20 different people. Now, that sounds a little crazy, a little risky, but those were the odds that you were playing. So the instructions were generally brought back by an airman, and in my case, when I did return, they said, he has a big mouth, let him go around and tell other people. So I went around to the fighter bases, and I explained to the people how I got out. But the difficulty with that was that you could only tell them what happened to you up until the point you got in the hands of an organization. And then you were to politely say, from that point forward, my trip was organized for me. Well, that didn't mean a heck of a lot to a guy that stopped there to go out on a mission tomorrow, and he says, yeah, your trip was organized, but by whom and what's the deal? So briefing, I suppose, meant different things to different airmen. And the speeches that we heard were probably more advantageous than the speeches that the intelligence officers gave. And so you had, one, you had instinct, you had instructions, and you had a hell of a lot of luck. And without the luck, you wouldn't have gotten out. And so we, you know, looking back on it 35 years ago in that perspective, I think that's my viewpoint on it.
Mr. Dumais, can you add anything to that about how people were briefed, what they should and should not do?
Well, I was a sergeant major in the Canadian Army, and I got about the same instructions as Ralph has just put out. Of course, nothing to do with networks after they got out. Well, there was one big thing to do is shut your mouth. That was about for everybody. And there was a question put there, and I didn't say anything about that. But they said how many people that consisted worked in a network. Well, there's one thing I must tell you, that in a network, there was no application form. And everybody helped. And so many people. So it might have been couple of hundred, this might be 1,000, I wouldn't know. I was chief of network, I'm supposed to know everything. But I certainly didn't go interfere in somebody else's kitchen about that. Everybody helped, and there were no lists or anything like that. I know they paid out the money for everything that was being done, and it was an awful lot of money, believe me. And the British paid for that. And I've got to take my hat off to that, because they spent millions on that. I know I spent a lot of money there, but there were no questions asked. I was told before leaving, never mind the money, don't keep account, just go ahead and get the airmen out. Thank you.
Our friend here has said, how did they get the money? It might be an interesting question, which it is, in fact. How did you receive the money?
Well, of course, they gave us some money leaving England, quite a bit of money. Well, I can say, if you like, they gave us, as we started out, 750,000 of a million francs. Quite a stack of money, 750,000. This is only a starter. Of course, once we got some results, they got the first shipment across, then I had asked for more money, because as a starter, you do need quite a bit more money. And then they shipped me 4 million francs after that. And then, without my asking anymore, seeing that the airmen were coming across, they sent me another 4 million. And I said, hey, stop it. I don't know what to do with the damn thing. Because this may sound crazy, but what do you know? They send you a satchel about that long, that wide, that deep, I should say, and that thick. That's full of 10,000 franc notes. Pressed down hard. They don't iron them out, because that would show. They just press them. And had them bundle them, press them and all that, so they don't take too much stuff, and you get a satchel like that, 4 million francs. What do you do with it? It's money. So you can't carry that in your pocket. You can't put in your cupboard. You're late, it gets stolen. You can't take it to the bank. What the hell would you say to a bank manager?